Okay, so welcome to today's lecture in programming languages. Last time we have been going all the way from the basic atomic operations that typical hardware architectures offer offer as an interface for programming languages to achieve very basic synchronization operations. And we have then quickly moved on to use them as basic building blocks for larger synchronization utilities, reaching block-free algorithms, and used that as basic building blocks for locks, like semaphores or mutexes or monitors and condition variables. So with that, we have reached kind of a very high-level abstraction. However, what we also encountered is that these are entities that block the current threat from progressing further in its trace, with the property of possibly causing so-called deadlocks. So we have not been talking about deadlocks last time, so that's what we're going to do today. So deadlocks. The general idea of what a deadlock is that if we have two processes involved, and each of them is waiting for the other one to finish before it finishes itself, well, then usually none of those will finish, and this is what situation we call a deadlock. And well, so far this is only with two participants, but of course you can extend this definition to arbitrary number of participants as long as there is a cyclic dependency from the participants to each other. So as soon as you can as you realize that there's a cyclic dependency, you know that there's a deadlock in these systems. So as a practical example, let's have a look at the code example from over here. So there's this Java class that carries a reference to some other object of the same type. For now it's null, but can be something completely different from that. And it offers a method bar, and this method is protected by a monitor. So that's what the synchronized means over here. And well, what this bar does is, apart from a few other things, it might in the end call the bar method of its internal reference to another foo object that it can access via this other thing. So, from that you might not directly see that there is a not immediately see that there's a deadlock, but this of course depends on the particular setting of the whole thing. So you can imagine two of these objects living in your virtual machine, with one referring to, with A referring to B via its other reference, and B referring to A via its other reference. So there's already, they're cross-referencing each other. And, of course, in Java you have a little bit more to concurrency than just this operator over here, which I just quickly made up in order to save space on the slides. But in principle, you would kind of have to start your threading environment and have runnables and then start your thread and all that. I summarize that with this parallel or concurrency operator over here. So you can imagine this method bar being called concurrently on object A and on object B, and if well progress on both of the threads is in a certain way, both of them will execute the code in there, and well, will try to execute the bar method of their internally referred other method, other object, which will in turn already have entered its own synchronized method, because it also executes its bar method. So this is a call that will most likely block. However, since the other one will do the same thing, also call its bar method on its referred other object, it will also block, because this one will also have already entered the bar method, thus it will have acquired its internal lock for the object likewise. So in that way, both of the threads are trying to execute their bar method while having acquired the lock responsible for the monitor, and will try to enter another monitored method whose internal lock is already given to or acquired by the respective other object. So, well, at that point, none of them can do any progress anymore, and both of them will never finish. So that is kind of a quick construction of an actual deadlock. So, question is now, well, this is for sure a problem since the early days of concurrency, and there might be already a few insights into this kind of behavior. And, well, turns out there is. There's a publication from 1971 where there are following conditions formalized for deadlocks. So for deadlocks to actually happen, what you will have to presume in your programming system is that there is of course some way of organizing mutual exclusion. So there's some way for processes to gain exclusive access to certain parts. If that's not the case, then, well, there won't be any deadlocks in that sense. Then these facilities have the property of well, a kind of a waiting state while having active possession of resources, so that they can somehow prevent others from the acquisition of these held resources. So that is one of the properties. Then there's the thing that well, if I can take away the resources from a blocked process, then I could somehow maybe satisfy the waiting conditions of some other thread, helping this one to terminate, thus freeing other resources, which would help the first thread to terminate. But if I don't have any means of preemption, then, well, I'm still in the situation of deadlock. And then, of course, what also needs to happen is that there is this condition of a circular dependency. So if the waiting processes have dependencies on each other, and those dependencies form a cycle, then I will run into such a deadlock. So those are the conditions that all contribute to a deadlock to happen. So the thing is that for a deadlock to be there, you need all of these properties to be fulfilled. So if you are after, well, or if you pursue the idea of getting rid of deadlocks, it's already sufficient to remove only one of these conditions, and you will get rid of deadlocks. So, well, if you accept that there's deadlocks in your system, because you've designed it that way, what can you actually do if such an deadlock occurs? Well, one thing is you might just say, well, let's just try what happens and just ignore the fact that deadlocks occur. Well, that might be reasonable in systems where deadlocks are not so very frequent and it's not really crucial for the system to be shut down and started once again after a little while that you have realized that there's deadlocks. Well, that might be a thing. However, that is kind of a very pragmatic solution and maybe not what we're really after in this context here. So ignoring might be feasible. However, for sophisticated systems, that might be not what you're after. The other thing would be, well, you could try to actually actively scan your system for whether there actually is a deadlock happening right now, and if there is, you might want to sort it out such that the deadlock can be resolved, which would usually work in a way that you would preempt one of the threats, thus taking away its resources, somehow maybe kill only that particular threat, for example, and have the other one continue and hope that the system around will somehow manage to recover and try to live with that. So if your system supports this notion of preemption and maybe restarting or somehow repairing whatever has been destroyed when preemption has happened, then that might be a viable solution. So detection is one option. Then there's the idea of actual prevention. So that would be the approach of designing your system in a way such that you can actually never really come to a deadlock. So that would be, of course, a very nice thing because you don't have to then go after the whole thing and repair or even live with a broken system in the end. So that's kind of a very desirable thing. And, well, there's another idea out there, which is the avoidance. So this is a system that's usually, or this is an idea that usually comes with the notion of trying to predict the next steps of the threats that are running on your system, and in case that threats are likely to run into a deadlock at some point later, you might want to well pause one of the threats that are taking part in this deadlock until maybe the surroundings have somehow sorted everything out and it's not dangerous anymore to go further. Well, that might be a solution, but at least here we don't show any idea that goes into that direction. Instead, what we're focusing right now is the idea of preventing deadlocks by designing your system in a deadlock-free way. So that is the thing that is kind of the the only viable solution so far in standard operating systems. So what can you do in order to prevent that? Well, of course, you can try to get rid of locking at all. We could do so by lock-free algorithms, and there's a whole community out there that is trying to replace lock-based parts of software that is heavily used, for example, in libraries, with implementations that are lock-free. And that's an area where you can still kind of earn your merits by publishing lock-free versions of so far established lock-based algorithms. And yeah, so that is one of the ideas. But, well, what happens if you are like me and not so intelligent in terms of concurrent programming and would like to still work with locking? Well, then you might want to design your algorithm in a way such that your locking is actually not harmful and will actually not occur. And as I said before, one of the ways of preventing deadlocks would be to tackle the conditions that are out there for deadlocks to actually occur. And the usual way of redesigning your system is to attack the condition of cyclic dependency in deadlocked systems. So if you can make sure that there will never be a cycle in the dependencies of threads on each other, then you can be sure that there's no deadlock actually happening. And well, that is something that you can achieve by, for example, establish a particular ordering on the acquisition of locks. If you can make sure that the acquisition of locks happens in a partially ordered way, then of course, since there's a particular ordering on there, there will never be a situation where you can run into a cyclic dependency anymore. So that is a desirable property of locked programs. So, well, can you find something like that in a generic way? Can you, at least for a program, actually really prove that it is deadlock-free by kind of trying to prove that there is a partial order on the acquisition of locks? Those might be interesting questions to answer if you are in a situation where you need to write reliable software and have to somehow argue whether the thing that you have produced is actually working without deadlocks. So that is an approach that I will show you here. So, well, for that, or at least most of the approaches that are out there, have a certain way of carrying out this argument, and most of or at least a lot of them are circling around the idea of so-called lock sets. So what is a so-called lock set? So these lock sets are usually sets of so far acquired locks with respect to particular program points. So lock sets per se are maybe not so particularly interesting. You always have to relate them to particular locations in your program. And well, if you would always exactly know which lock is acquired at a particular program point, you would be very happy. However, due to certain results in decidability, you will not be able to, in general, find out what the lock sets actually really look like for arbitrary programs. Instead, what you can talk about is this not actual precise sets, but so-called May sets, which means that those sets don't hold the precise the precise locks that are actually really held at each time at that program point, but instead it holds a set of locks that may be held at that program point in each and every execution. If a lock is actually held, then you can be sure that you will find that in this may set. So it has kind of a one. It has kind of a notion of being precise in one direction. So if there is a lock hold held, you will find it in the may set. But not every lock that is mentioned in the may set is a lock for which you can be sure that it's actually being held at that program point. So this is a notion of over approximation of the locks held at a certain program point. So what do you gain by this complication? Well, as I said before, you cannot really compute the actual concrete set of locks held at every program point, but going from the precise information to an over-approximation, you can now start thinking about algorithms that do these computations, because for over-approximations, you can actually find algorithms that that can actually be computed. Well, of course, you can always have this kind of trivial algorithm that says, well, at every program point, all of the locks can be held, and that is already an over-approximation, and thus fits into that category. However, that's maybe not the most useful one out there. So, anyway, in principle, you can compute over approximations, and that's what we're gonna kind of sketch in the next few slides. This is a very rough approach to computing lock sets. In practice, you can invest a lot more effort and intelligence in setting up systems to compute this and refine the basic approach that you see over here into something that gives you a tighter notion of over-approximation than the thing that you're going to see here. But in principle, the approaches work like this. So, what we're going to be talking about is a partial order that we're going to set up on the acquisition of locks. And in order to do so, what we will need to do is, well, we will need to set up a transitive closure on a particular relation. So if we order two acquisitions, then and have another ordering where the pairs are somehow compatible with each other, we want to extend this ordering to the outermost acquisitions, and that is what the transitive closure will give us. So usually what I am after is that if I have my ordering established between two acquisitions x1 and x2, and have another have also established the ordering between x2 and x3, then usually I also am interested in the or assume that x1 and x3 are ordered with respect to each other. So that is why I set up this transitive closure on relations. So that's just to define for you what I mean when I use this plus syntax. So back to the actual ordering of lock acquisition. So what I'm going to do in this algorithm is that I will go through my program code, and along my path through the program, what I'm going to do is I will track which locks I'm currently holding, and each time that I collect a new lock, or each time that I meet a new acquisition of a lock, I get of course, the information that now this lock is also held, but also what I get is that, well, this has been happening after all the other locks have been already acquired. So this is information that contributes to ordering on locks. So what I'm going to do during my run through the program is, of course, for one point, keep track of the held locks. That is what I do in this. Well, basically, what I do is I'm keeping a map from program points to the set or the main set of locks that I have acquired so far. I can access that with this lambda of the program point. And as a side effect, what I do is I will set up the so-called lock order, which I will represent with this little triangle, and I will set it up in such a way that the newly encountered lock acquisition over here will lead to my newly detected lock to be entering in lock order with respect to all the old locks that have been gathered so far in my main lock set for that particular program point. So with that, what I can do is I will step by step by going through the program, of course, collect every lock that is possibly held, and well, of course, also release it whenever I pass a signal or a monitor leave. But as a side effect, what I will also do is that I will step by step extend my lock order each time that I find that there's a new lock that is acquired. And when I'm done with going through my program, what I will do is then I will take the transitive closure of the lock order that I've gathered so far, and with that I get my ordering on the locks. So with that now, having traversed my program and collected all possible orderings between the locks, I can then check whether there's an actual cycle in my locks by checking whether the lock order is established between, well, not between several partners, but lock order is actually happening between the lock and the lock itself. So if that is something that I have collected, then I could construct such a cyclic dependency between these things. And if I cannot find any of those things, well, then my program is in principle free of deadlocks. That sounds quite nice to have, and a good thing to have. However, life is maybe not that simple, because there's also this notion of monitors, for which, well, acquisition of the monitor is actively promoted as being really allowed. So, well, since on Mutesys this is exactly what is locking, but on monitors it's considered to be behaving differently, we need to disambiguate between those two things. So what we're going to do is we will split up this general lock space into a lock space for semaphores and a lock space for monitors, and formulate our deadlock freedom a little bit differently. Particularly, what we will do is that for all locks that come from the set of semaphore locks, I want to disallow that there's that I can construct a cycle in the lock ordering. And if one of the locks participating in that is a monitor, then if I can construct any any cyclic dependency on that with anything that I call B over here, if I can construct something like this, then this B needs to be the same as the A. So this is the only dependency that I should be able to derive from that should be between the monitor variable and itself. Every other cyclic dependency should not be possible in that system. So, yeah, if that is the case, then my system is considered to be free of deadlocks. Okay, so that now sorts out the issue of having semaphores and monitors in my concept. However, there's still one problem, particularly the problem of talking about what does it mean when I encounter that a particular lock is acquired or released as an instruction in my program. The actual instances of a lock, not the the identifiers that I use in my program, but the actual instances, maybe created via new or something, might actually be different at a particular program point, depending on the context on which we reach that particular instance. So, if you have, for example, several objects, all of them having their own mutex carrying with them, of course, if you then reach a program point inside a method of that particular object, you can't always say that they will be the same mutex acquired and released, because, well, this might vary between the instances of that particular class. There might be several mutexes created for that. So it's not as simple as it looks the first in the first moment. So what you will usually do in these situations is you won't actually talk about concrete instances anymore, but instead you will talk about summarizations of the actual locks or monitors that can be found at runtime at particular program points. And, that might mean that you have to somehow treat several in reality actually different instances of locks as one summarized locks and as one summarized lock, and try to compute your algorithm on these things. That is a kind of a common compromise that you have to do in order to still be able to actually really compute something meaningful. Otherwise, you will kind of you cannot really cover all possible executions of a program at once without executing each and every one of them, and that is something that's not really feasible to do. So, you need to live with this compromise of having to talk about classes of locks, for example, or these summarized locks in that sense. So, if you move over to doing your analysis on these summarized locks and monitors, then, of course, these might represent several concrete ones, and if that is the case, and it turns out that you derive from this this algorithm that there's a cycle on these summarized locks, well, that is a thing that now is a little bit problematic, because this might actually really indicate that there's a problem in terms of deadlocks. However, since this is a summarized lock, in reality you might have several instances that don't really interfere with each other, and thus don't matter whether there's a cycle between, or maybe there is not an actual cycle because they are actually separate locks in reality. So This notion of summarization might turn your result into something which you cannot really deal with very well anymore. So in order to still give a safe answer to the question of whether an algorithm is deadlock-free or not, well, what you would usually do is you would disallow, even for summarized summarized locks, to have an actual dependencies on itself. And this means that you might miss a few programs that are actually deadlock-free and classify them as possibly deadlocking, but get the benefit of if you don't run into such a self cycle, then you can say for sure that the that your program that you have found is actually deadlock free. So this is the compromise at that situation. That's kind of the easy way out. There's also other ideas of kind of refining your algorithm by realizing that if you have found such a dependency on a or a self-dependency on a summary lock, that you should then make more effort to disambiguate the possible locks that can end up in the summarization and separate them from each other with a little bit of effort. You can do that for a limited amount of locks, and that might help you to sort out this self-dependency, but that is far beyond what we want to do over here. So what we are going to be doing is that we are going to look at the at lock sets and summaries of them in practical examples, and use them to verify that a program does not contain deadlocks. We cannot really verify that a program will definitely have a deadlock. That is something that we can't do with these summarizations. So what we usually will do is we will try to identify the mutex locks and the summarized monitor locks, and with those, we will try to establish our run through the program and collecting the program order. In order to give still meaningful meaningful advice, what we will also try to do is we will try to identify the non-summary monitor locks and sort these according to the lock sets and check whether there's self cycles on the non-summary monitors and the mutex locks. So the question is now, what can you do as a programmer if find out that the lock order that you have inferred with this algorithm actually contains a cycle? Well, first of all, you of course usually are aware that lock sets are an approximation, so this might not actually be the case in concrete executions, but you might want to check the spots where you have found a cycle in the lock order. A simple way of making sure that there's no cycle in lock order is that you consider all the locks in your program as having already an implicit order. Like, for example, with an array of locks that you use, you always start with the smallest index of the locks that you need, and step by step acquire them in increasing index, for example. And if you do that, you will never be able to actually really create a cycle in the lock order if each and every part of your program uses the same way of acquiring locks. If it turns out that well, you for example uncover a particular location of your program where acquiring a lock is violating the so far accumulated lock order, what you could also do is start changing the program in the way that you release the lock that is actually the one responsible for violating the lock order, acquire the lock that you originally wanted to acquire, and then reacquire the lock that had been conflicting before. That way you have switched the ordering in which you want to acquire the locks round, and still arrive at the state where you hold all of the locks that you have been after. This is of course something that only works if you haven't in between already started hurting any invariants on your resources, and works usually best when you have programs where all the locks that you are planning to use are acquired in one phase before anything else is really modified. So this might not be a general approach for you. You might have to move the acquisition of locks to a very early point in your program. And yeah, of course, the problem is when you reach these summarized lock states and find that there's a self-dependency on these summarized things. Well, in those situations, you can't do some generic thing, and in that case, you're probably stuck and have to try to figure out something more simple to design, or well, use a more sophisticated algorithm for detecting deadlocks. But yeah, that's beyond the scope of this thing. So. Yeah, an example for the situation where you can't really disambiguate within a summarized lock. That is our introduction example. For that, you would have to summarize all the possible objects that you can collect in your other attribute. And, there is no real good way of disambiguating between all the possible objects that will somehow reach the other properties, so you will have to summarize, and well, for that the deadlock algorithm will create such a summarized lock, and thus will end up finding a self dependency and not be able to classify that the program is deadlock free, but yeah, well, in that sense, it's the original program is not deadlock free anyway. So, to round up, one step back again to this concept of atomic execution that we had before, and the locks that we have introduced in between, and you might want to be interested in whether working with locks is actually the same as just surrounding the parts that you have locked with atomic. And turns out that if you do this fine-grained protection of critical sections with explicit locking via weight and signal, you can express a few properties that you can't directly transfer to your atomic annotations. For example, in a program like this, where you establish the acquisition of this lock T, for example, and then internally acquire another lock S. And this is something that, for example, makes it possible to still work on to still have a little bit of concurrency. For example, during this period over here, you could still work on other regions of the program that have acquired S in between, but not the ones that acquire T, for example. If you go over to this atomic keyword, so to say, this is not a thing that is quite easy to express in that sense. So differentiating between the necessities of particular sections in your code is something that doesn't translate too well into this atomic block that we have introduced in that way. So also trying to derive locks from the atomic declarations and trying to establish only the locks that are really necessary in order to make the your regions behave like they would have done with atomic is not a very trivial thing to do. So yeah, that's not too easy to relate to each other. So anyway, dealing with weight and signal is probably something which is might be tedious if you you have quite complicated algorithms, and writing just these atomic blocks seems to be a very comfortable thing to do all in all. So what you could do in order to work just with atomic sections is to, for example, establish a single mutex for all of the atomic blocks that you have in your program, and just use this single lock to protect the entrance of these atomic blocks and release it on whenever the atomic block is finished. Would be one possible way of implementing atomic sections. However, with that you will get very little concurrency in the system, because would kind of very strictly keep other atomic sections from being executed at the same time as your own atomic section is executed, and even if the atomic sections don't touch any common resources, they would still have to be executed in sequence. So that is something that might be a little bit too severe for you. So also a few statements might only modify things that are private to them, the notion of that they are kind of local. For example, for those you wouldn't even require any lock. You could try to put more intelligence in that by trying to use more fine-grained notions of locks, but then you run into these deadlocking problems, which you could try to circumvent with this idea of having these phases of acquisition and of releasing, and the notion of dropping certain mutexes when they violate a global order of all the lock acquisitions. But this might be a thing which is quite performance computation intensive. So it's that might not be what you're really after. So this is something that is usually not really done in programming languages, at least with the means that we have seen so far. But we will continue with other means that give you more or a larger tool set in that respect. So, all in all, what can you expect in languages that are out there in the wild and heavily used to find with respect to what we have heard so far? So most programming languages offer some notion of idioms for synchronization. So there's the idea of having atomic operations accessible and this is something that is offered, for example, in C and C++, with which you can then implement weight-free algorithms. And to continue this thing, this would then lead to the aspect of log-free algorithms and log constructs, which are then things that are offered not only in C, C++, but for example also in these higher level languages like Java, C sharp, or whatever comes after that. And those usually provide constructs like monitors or similar concepts like semaphores, mutices, and all that, which often simplify the programming but have similar problems as the more lower level constructs. So this is kind of the state as it was last year. Hope it hasn't changed too much of that. So barriers you can expect to be able to access from languages like C and C++. For things like Java, to use barriers you would have to implicitly do that via this volatile specifier. Well, and I don't know, I didn't put it as a direct means of accessing in this table over here. Then there's the notion of this weight and log free programming, which is usually done with these log prefix to certain assembly instructions. And since for that you need somehow need to be able to access the underlying assembler, well, I have put the tick in C, C++, and for Java and C sharp, I think there's a few newer libraries in the newer versions of that that somehow also make wait and log-free instructions accessible via function calls. So there's this util concurrent atomic package, as well as the system threading interlocked package for the C sharp friends here. So this is where you can find the means for implementing log-free algorithms. Then there's the concepts of semaphores and mutices, which are well accessible as libraries from C, C++. And for the higher level languages, well, you would usually have monitors with which you could somehow try to simulate data structures similar to semaphores and mutices. However, they usually can do much more than just your plain semaphore mutex does, but you can still use them in a similar fashion. So that is what you usually get offered from your program languages of choice. So all in all, what we have seen is the notion of weight-free and log-free and locked programming. So these are the three concepts which we have built up step by step. What we will look at next on the list is transactional memory, which is a way that you can realize these atomic blocks in a very comfortable fashion. We have had a focus on the weight-free algorithms, for example, and we have seen that they never block, they usually always succeed, they never deadlock, and don't have any starvation. So this is the kind of best that you can get in terms of behavior, but they are very limited in expressivity. So this is kind of the pros thing, and this is kind of the bad thing in there. Then, from weight-free algorithms, we made the step to log-free algorithms by, well, composing them in a appropriate way, and those have the properties of never blocking, but maybe failing. They never deadlock, but due to retrying to apply their changes over and over and over again, this might lead to starvation. So this is kind of the feature set that you can expect from that. The kind of restriction that this offers is, well, for these log-free algorithms, you always need to be able to do these atomic updates on this limited space in memory, and this usually is just realized with a few bytes, 8 on the Intel architecture, for example, and you might find that not sufficient for your type of algorithm. So this might show the restrictions of that. Then there's the idea of locking algorithms, which can guard arbitrary code, so there is no restriction on the actual code that you can synchronize with that. You can use several locks to get a control on the granularity of concurrency. However, you buy yourself a ticket to deadlocks with that, and you need to do special efforts in order to make the semaphores comfortable with respect to re-entrancy, for example, so that leads to the desire for monitors, and but that comes with its own price to pay in terms of performance. So that is locking algorithms for you. So whatever type of algorithm you're after, you would usually use the algorithm best fit for your problem. So that's it for the synchronization primitives. If you're in for more information, these are the two references that I took most of the things from. And I would like to continue with transactional memory if you don't have any question about that. No? Okay, so let's... So, with respect to concurrency, if you're in for larger systems where you don't want to have a lot of concerns of low-level primitives, you are usually also following ideas like abstraction from details and internals from certain constructs, and also are usually after the idea of ideally you would like to build basic blocks with which you then construct larger entities in your software, and you can do so by composing smaller entities into larger entities. So this is a thing that if you try to apply your usual techniques like monitors or mutexes, then you might run into certain situations where you reach the borders of what you can comfortably do with these concepts. So take, for example, a situation where you have already implemented a basic data structure like a list, and you have done so with concurrency in mind, so you have protected the externally accessible functions like an iterating function for all, or a push for adding new things to your linked list with a lock, for example. Then you might want to offer another building block that builds upon the one that you have already provided, which would be, for example, a set which would also offer an interface like push. Then it would use the push from the underlying list, but itself it would, for example, offer a thing like the insert operation. And in order to get the insert right on the underlying data structure, you would of course want to make sure that the object that's going to be pushed into the set is not already managed by the set so far. So that would usually first set up a call to for all, and then later on use a push if the for all has not encountered a similar object already being managed by the underlying list. So the thing is now that the original object, list object, has already been developed with concurrency in mind. Thus, there is kind of a lock already in place. So this for all, for example, is protected by the lock, as well as the push, so that if you do them in a concurrent way, they don't interfere with each other. However, now that you have the idea of using the list as a building block for the set, for example, you extend the protocol in which this is used in a way that the insert uses the for all and the push subsequently, but still would need its own algorithm to be non-interrupted in that sense. So you would want to prevent that between the for all and the push call, some other thread pushes in between, because that would mean that you could end up with having a duplicate in your set. So with the so far protected methods, you can't guarantee that. So what you would usually do is you would introduce a new lock and protect the for all and the push with that new lock, which then also means that every other path that leads to the underlying the underlying data structure would need to use the same lock in order to not interfere with that. So you essentially end up with having to do, first of all your protection from concurrent accesses once again, although this is already had been achieved in your underlying data type. And also what you create is that, of course, there's now two locks involved in the whole process, meaning that all this wait and signaling has to be done twice now in order for the whole... you can maybe find a way to kind of link into the internal of the other thing, but then this would mean that there's kind of internals once again exposed for the whole thing. So there's always... a conflict happening between this notions of abstraction and composition and the means that you have to establish concurrency in these systems. So that might be more difficult than you would desire the whole thing to actually be. You have to take into account that you want to chain them in some particular way. So a different way to look on that is the idea to have these atomic blocks that we have already introduced a little bit before, and have them automatically ensure the atomic executions of the statements. And particularly what you would want from these systems is that they are somehow composable, in the sense that if you have, for example, your atomic block internally calls something which is also specified as atomic, you would want to keep it that way and even consider the whole thing as an atomic execution and let the implementation figure out what is necessary to do in order to achieve atomicity on that thing. So the idea is to come up with a notion of transactions, like the code that is inside of an atomic block is considered to be such a transaction. And in case that you reach things like nested atomic blocks, you would treat them the same way as if they would be a single atomic block. And while these transactions run, you would want to check that there's no conflict due to other processes running and accessing data in concurrent fashion. So what happens if there is actually another thread that interferes with the things that you do during your transaction. Well, you what you usually have as a concept here is that you kind of revert everything that you have done so far and restart your transaction. A little bit similar to the way that you have seen in database lectures, for example. There's also this notion of transaction there. And this is the idea with transactional memory, is to carry this notion over to programming languages and have them behave as if it would, the whole thing would be kind of a database in that sense. And in order to be able to restart the transaction also in a programmatic way, well, you might want to offer something like a retry keyword also for your newly invented transactions then. So what is specific for transactions is, well, probably mostly known to you, since I think database lectures are, what is it? Is it third or fourth semester already? So is there anyone who hasn't been to database lectures so far? So that is probably not so surprising for you then. So there's this ACID properties, like atomicity is one of the things, which means that the transaction has a kind of an all or nothing property, so it either completes or appears as if it hadn't been run so far. There's a notion of consistency, so that all that you can observe from a system is that at each time that you can do an observation, all the states that you can see are actually consistent in the sense that certain invariants hold for these observable states. And well, whatever this invariant would mean would depend on the actual application and would be your concern as a programmer to make sure that they are held whenever you leave such a transaction. And there's this notion of isolation, in the sense that transactions don't interfere with each other while they are running, which is a thing which is not so evident what that means with respect to transactional memory, since there might be code around that accesses memory in a non-transactional way, and that is the thing that's maybe a little bit different to what databases are giving you. So it's not so clear what should actually happen in these situations. And then there's this idea of durability, and that is something that probably bothers databases a lot more than programming languages, because since, well, storing into the main memory already is kind of our notion of making a change to the system permanent. So there's, at least in, from the first glance, there's not so much involved with respect to memory hierarchies than before, than in databases. So apart from that, you have this notions of transactions needing to be serializable. If that is the case, then you have this these properties of atomicity, for example. So these the results of concurrent transactions must be identical to a to an arbitrary execution of them in space. So you should find one serialization of the concurrent threads such that the result that you got in these transactional systems corresponds to that. So that gives you this serializability property, and that is kind of how you would define the semantics of these transactions. So a thing that is of interest in transactional systems with respect to program languages is a thing that, at least in my to my knowledge, is not so not so prominent in database systems, which is the consistency during transactions. So what these ACID properties are all about is how the transactions are seen when they are committed, but there's no actual notion of what happens until a transaction commits or on the way of committing. So there, of course, might be transactions that somehow create an inconsistent state or are run on an inconsistent state, and they, at least for some time, do things that might destroy certain invariants. And this is well, what these and these transactions are usually considered to be zombie transactions. And of course, in an ideal world, these zombie transactions would not be existing because they would be aborted quite quite quickly. However, in practical systems, they might still be around for some time, and usually they should be considered to not interfere with the committing ones. However, this might somehow be a problem when you consider the context of programming languages. For example, in the code that you see over here, where you have transaction over here, which works on the variables x and y, and x and y, for example, are presumed to always keep the invariant x is the same as y, and the transaction on the right hand side is one that, well, temporarily might break the invariant in between these two instructions over here, for example. However, in the end, the invariant is restored once again, and when the transaction is committed, then the invariant holds, and the system is considered to be consistent. However, depending on how the transactional system is actually implemented, it might be that the transaction on the left hand side is at some point run concurrently to the transaction on the right hand side and tries to also work on the variables x and y, and for example access x and y during the execution of the transaction on the right hand side. And since our properties only say that the consistency is fulfilled for a committed transaction, this this one might, for example, access the variables x and y while the other one is running, which is not a consistent state and will in the end lead to the transaction on the left hand side to be rolled back and redone at some point. However, in programming languages, you can have things like assertions, exceptions, or other errors to be, well, they can be thrown with arbitrary, well, at arbitrary positions. You can just put them in there. And in that case, for example, this might lead to a problem, since this is a transaction which will, since it has seen an inconsistent state, at some point be cancelled and reverted back to beginning and rerun again. But if that is not done immediately, but control reaches, for example, this thing over here, then you run into a situation where an error is actually triggered, and the this threat might be completely destroyed before there had been a chance of reverting that transaction back to the beginning. So this is a thing that happens due to this nature of, well, some implementations which might still grant you access on inconsistent states, but rely on the fact that at some point some kind of lazy mechanism will interact and revert the transactions that have been accessing these inconsistent states. Well, those might run into problems, and there's a lot of different ideas how this could lead to fatal errors, like, for example, null pointer dereferentiations or divisions by zero, or, well, some other exceptions thrown or errors triggered. So for concrete systems, you might want to be interested in also properties that that talk about what happens for non-committing transactions. And this is the property that you see over here, this opacity. So a transactional memory system provides opacity if even failing transactions are serializable with respect to committing transactions. So in that sense, even a failing transaction can be, you can find a sequential order of all these transactions to be executed such that the behavior of even the failing transaction fits into the context of all the other transactions. So failing transactions in that sense will always see a consistent view of the memory. Then there's this notion of isolation, which we have also highlighted in the summary a little bit, where in the context of computer language environment or language system offers several ways of approaching accesses to memory. In this system, it's not guaranteed that all the accesses to every memory thing is always happening in a transaction or with from inside such an atomic block. And if that is the case, then isolation is a thing that has now a completely or has an extended focus. So the thing is, what happens if we mix transactional code with accesses to memory that is happening non-transactionally? Is isolation still talking about that, or is that something that simply is not treated at all? So in systems of weak isolation, there's actually no conflict detection for non-transactional accesses to memory. So that, of course, means that if you access common memory variables, you get the same race problems as in unlocked shared accesses. So if you happen to have an access to a variable X in a transaction and access to variable X from without a transaction, then these might still race. So there is the idea of instead having the notion of strong isolation, and that is one where accesses from within transactional memory and non-transactional memory instructions are still remaining isolated from each other. So these are the two kind of approaches to isolation in transactions in programming languages. So in order to talk about the semantics of how memory accesses work with transactions, there is this concept of so-called single lock atomicity, which is saying that the program executes as if all the transactions acquire a single program-wide mutual exclusion lock. So that is kind of the reference semantics that you can assume to hold when you or the reference semantics for single lock atomicity based transactional memory systems. So this is again quite similar to what the sequential consistency was for ordinary concurrent access. This is a model of that that defines the semantics of what you do with means of statements about equivalence to a particular execution model. So this is has certain properties, particularly this single lock atomicity model is in some respects a quite strong model in the sense that for example over here where the you have a thread over here which uses an atomic transaction over here, and thread 2 which also has a transaction, and thread 1 executes, well, accesses basically no memory at all, while thread 2 accesses memory at address F, of X here at that point. And if you emanate from this definition of single lock atomicity, this would need to act as if you would acquire a single lock and share it between all the possible transactions. And if you do that in that sense, well, there is an infinite loop in this one over here, which means that the global lock that you would use to define this transaction would, well, never be released since this loop is not terminating, which would mean that even thread 2, which has nothing to do with thread 1 in the first place in terms of the memory it touches, would not be able to acquire the lock, thus would never be able to progress or, well, to execute its transaction in that sense. So the progress guarantee for transactions in the SLA semantics is quite weak in that sense. However, SLA in other respects acts quite strongly. For example, over here where we have again two threads with transactional blocks over here, one that doesn't do anything particular apart from existing, which means that all it does is acquiring the lock at some point. And here the thread 2, which also has a transaction, but this time does a few things. It does read the data and the ready thing. And although thread 1, for example, never really accesses the these memory locations within an actual transaction, just opening this this empty transaction over here serializes the accesses to this data 1 and ready 1 such that the thread 2 will still be able to access them as if they would be guaranteed in that particular order. So implicitly, this empty atomic block acts as a barrier to other threads in that sense. So intuitively, since within the atomic blocks, they don't really access the same data, those two threads should rather act in an independent way. However, in reality, they are not that independent anymore. Instead, they synchronize with each other. So, well, this is kind of a strong thing to happen in a memory model in that sense. So, yeah, in order to implement strong isolation, this is maybe not the right model to choose. So There's alternative reference models, for example, the transactional sequential consistency, which has a little bit of a different notion to it. And what this is defined at is that this model, the accesses that happen within each transaction are meant to be sequentially consistent. So what that enables is a particular notion of, well, there is strong isolation between the between the different transactions, so there is a little bit of concurrency in there. However, within the transaction, the accesses are not allowed to be reordered anymore. So it's a quite strong restriction on semantics of whatever happens within each transaction in that sense. So, yeah, in that sense, it's not clearly a weaker or stronger model than the SLA, but well, something kind of a side grade to that. So the actual implementations out there usually use what is basically the transactional sequential consistency model as a reference model with a few race-free reorderings enabled. So yeah, whatever that means in practice, we will see. So there's now concrete implementations of transactional memory, which I think don't fit into the time slot that we have until the end of the lecture anymore. So we will do concrete transactional memory systems next time. So there's the software transactional memory and hardware transactional memory that I would like to introduce you to. So thank you so far, and see you next time.